the evidence of the president's perjury cannot be presented without specific, explicit, and possibly offensive descriptions of sexual encounters. Here are a few. Lewinsky says she had 10 sexual encounters with the president, which generally occurred in or near the private study off the Oval Office, most often in the windowless hallway outside the study. Lewinsky says she performed oral sex on the president on 9 occasions, and on all 9 of those occasions, the president fondled and kissed her bare breasts. That alone would fit the definition of sexual relations from the Jones deposition. In addition to physical contact, Lewinsky said she had phone sex with the president 10 or 15 times, and that he called her at least 50 times. Starr says these details have been checked, cross-checked, and corroborated. Between 1995 and 1998, Lewinsky told 11 people, including her mother and her psychologist, about her relationship with the president, sometimes in great detail. And then there is the physical evidence. The report says the FBI confirmed that the semen stain on one of Lewinsky's dresses was an almost certain match with the president's DNA. Starr also accuses the president of obstructing justice in several different ways. According to Lewinsky, the president from the outset stressed the importance of keeping the relationship secret. Lewinsky said the president told her something to the effect, "If the two people who were involved say it didn't happen, it didn't happen." According to Lewinsky, after she was named as a witness in the Jones case, the president reminded her of the cover stories they had come up with about saying she was delivering letters to him or coming to visit Betty Curry, his secretary. Curry is quoted extensively as well. She acknowledged during her grand jury testimony that she sometimes would come to the White House for the sole purpose of having Lewinsky admitted and bringing her to see the president. Curry also testified that she went to Lewinsky's Watergate apartment to retrieve gifts that the president had given the former intern. Curry said she couldn't remember whether it was at the president's request. But Curry said that the day after the president testified in the Jones deposition, Mr. Clinton told Curry he had been asked about Lewinsky. Curry testified that the president said, "I think there are several things you may want to know." Mr. Clinton then made a series of statements to Curry about Lewinsky, according to the report. "You were always there when she was there, right? We were never really alone. Monica came on to me, and I never touched her, right?" Mrs. Curry testified, based on the president's demeanor, that the president wanted her to agree with his assertions, even though Mrs. Curry knew some of those statements to be false. Starr also outlines the president's efforts to find Lewinsky employment after he ended his sexual relationship with her. Lewinsky says she was distraught and emotional during this period, and even wrote the president a letter, quote, obliquely threatening to disclose their relationship. Starr says the president's attempts to find Lewinsky a job in New York with the help of his friend Vernon Jordan shows further evidence of obstruction of justice, since at the time Lewinsky could have provided damaging testimony against the president. Statements of denial to his aides once the Lewinsky scandal was made public were also cited by Starr as obstruction of justice. These aides were potential grand jury witnesses, says the Starr report, and Mr. Clinton's actions provide further proof that the president was engaging in a pattern of conduct that was inconsistent with his constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws. Martha Raddatz, NPR News, Washington.
We're joined now by two of our reporters who've also been going over the report since it was released this afternoon and who've been covering the story before today, Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and White House correspondent Mara Liasson. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Hi, Robert.
I'd like to begin with Nina, first of all, on the question of perjury. Many of the grounds for impeachment that are proposed by the independent counsel could only be committed by a president of the United States, if indeed they are grounds for impeachment, but perjury is a crime that has that anyone can commit. Do they have a good case?
Well, it's probably the strongest case in the report because the president, even the president, admits misleading first the lawyers in the Jones deposition, and then the independent counsel contends that he continued this charade in the grand jury by claiming that his testimony had been technically true, in essence, when it wasn't even technically true. And then he goes on, as Martha Raddatz indicated, to, in rather lurid detail, explain why. And certainly any common sense person reading that testimony, I think would have to say, it ain't true. But the president's lawyers can't say he lied under oath, because then he would have committed a felony. And if he committed a felony, isn't that an offense that is possibly seriously an impeachable offense? On the other hand, I have to say to you that perjury is a term of art, and you can really tell not the truth and not have committed perjury. There are lots of nits to pick and hairs to split, and Mr. Clinton's lawyers have picked and knitted every one of them.
In fact, in the document that was released today by the president's lawyers, which was dubbed in Washington the pre-buttle, since it actually came out before people had access to the independent counsel's report, there's much discussion and dispute of the claim of perjury. Mara, the lawyers there went great pains to show that, in their view, this was not perjury.
That's right. They say that perjury is a very specific thing, that when you're answering a fundamentally ambiguous question, your answer can never be considered perjury. The problem for the White House is that Starr has really, I think, defined the problem for Congress, or the question for Congress, is whether someone who lies under oath, let's put aside what's perjury and what's not perjury, whether someone who lies under oath should be president. And the White House lawyers are going to great pains to try to prove that he did not technically lie under oath. As they try to do that, their efforts to try to prove that are causing the president more political problems, because, as Nina pointed out, it's a hard thing for the public to swallow that kind of convoluted, hair-splitting legal argument. And today you had this spectacle of the White House counsel, Chuck Ruff, saying the president is no longer hiding behind legal language. No matter what his lawyers told him to do, he's out there saying he was wrong and he sinned and he's repenting. Well, he's got the music right, but the words are still the same. The lawyers are still making those arguments.
Well, perjury, though, is just one of the proposed grounds for impeachment that the independent counsel's report cites. Nina, there's also a general claim that the president was abusing his power by bringing all of his claims of privilege and trying to defer his appearance before the grand jury.
You know, the people that I've talked to today, including myself, I think this is probably the thinnest of the charges. In fact, one of the president's lawyers called them nonsense. Chuck Ruff, the president's counsel, White House counsel, called it nonsense. And that's in part because we really do know that the Secret Service, in waging the battle to keep the Secret Service agents from testifying, certainly the president could have waived the privilege if there was one. But it was the head of the Secret Service who most passionately demanded that they bring this case. And the lower courts have said that this was a legitimate case to bring, but that they were wrong on the law. Nobody has said this was a completely frivolous case. So it's a hard case, I think, to make that the president, in exercising a legal claim, was abusing his power.
Mara, the president's critics were especially put off by his national address after his grand jury appearance, by his attack on the independent counsel, on Kenneth Starr.
That's right.
But the document that came out of the White House today is no less pugnacious than the president's statements before. Do they think that, this must be a passionate point with them?
Well, it certainly is, and they believe this very strongly, that Starr is out to get the president. It's interesting, the president is no longer pushing that line. He's now saying that he's forgiving the people he was angry at, and he's no longer attacking Ken Starr personally, but his lawyers still are, and they're saying that this report was filled with lurid details for one reason, and one reason only, which was to embarrass and humiliate and damage the president and drive him from office. They are continuing along those lines, and they truly believe that. They also know that argument does have a certain amount of support, certainly among the Democratic base and among some Democratic members of Congress.
The president's lawyers argue that the offenses which rise to the level of impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors, are offenses against the state. It's not clear to me. Are they saying that, in fact, if he did commit perjury, that would not rise to the level of an impeachable offense?
It's interesting. They are saying two things. They're saying, number one, he didn't commit perjury, but even if he did, that wouldn't be an impeachable offense because it was about something personal. That if he created cover stories with Monica Lewinsky, that's what people do when they're having an affair. They really tried to set out an alternative narrative today. You know, the Starr report is written like a novel. It reads like a trashy novel. But they said, we want to tell you a different story. This is the story of a man who had an inappropriate relationship and tried to hide it.
In fact, they said, this is not a new story. This
That's
is
right.
what people do. The president,
from time immemorial.
Yes,
right.
The president in his grand jury testimony said, I would have had to have been an exhibitionist to have done made this clear to everybody. Of course I was trying to hide it.
The special prosecutor, the independent counsel, as he's formally known as, says that he had to be lured, as Martha Raddatz reported. His description has to be this detailed and graphic, because the question that was put to President Clinton in that deposition in the Paula Jones case had a lengthy description of what constitutes sexual relations. It involved touching various parts of the body, and therefore what he was doing during these episodes is absolutely relevant. Does this mean that from here on in, this is what the argument is going to be about? She said he was touching
well,
her here,
it,
but he says not?
Some of it's going to be about that. And in fact, in one point in the press conference that the president's lawyers had today, they were asked, is the president saying that she's lying when she says that he touched her breasts and other parts of her body? And the lawyer said, well, there may be differing recollections, but that's pretty much what we're down to in the question of what is sexual relations and what's not.
And also, if Congress is so inclined, they could go back and try to get the president to testify about these specific encounters. Don't forget, he didn't talk about the specific encounters. He gave a kind of blanket statement. He said what he did, but he didn't go into the kind of detail that Monica Lewinsky did. And in effect, he dared the independent counsel to kind of come after him for more.
Mara, was this the worst day of the Clinton White House that you've ever seen?
I think it was one of the worst. You know, Mike McCurry was asked that question today. Is this the saddest day here? And he said, goodness, no. We've had days when people died in plane crashes where Americans were killed around the world. Certainly, we can't say this is the saddest day, but this is certainly one of the worst that I've ever seen.
Mara Liasson, Nina Totenberg, thank you both very much. If perjury, as the White House is arguing, should not be thought of as a high crime or misdemeanor, an impeachable offense, then that raises the question of what consequences are in order for a sitting president who may have perjured himself. The president's lawyers were asked about that late this afternoon at the White House.
You said that the whatever offense the president has caused is not sufficient to warrant impeachment, but there is a great sentiment that he deserves some kind of rebuke. And I wonder if the president would be willing to accept some sort of censure by the Congress for his behavior that would stop short of impeachment or an effort to remove him from office.
I think the president at his prayer breakfast this morning said, legal language must not obscure the fact that I have done wrong. He has acknowledged wrongdoing as explicitly as he can. He's apologized. What we're dealing with here is whether the conduct that he has acknowledged and the allegations in the referral constitute evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors. Plainly, they do not. That's the issue before us.
Would you try to censure with the same energy that he intends to fight impeachment?
That's not a question before us in the report, and I'm just not going to speculate about
it. Let me just say in response to that, because I think it's important to understand, if there's been pain inflicted, it's happened. We know that if you're talking about a sanction, whether it be censure or public unhappiness with their president for what he did in his personal capacity, there's no question he's feeling that right now, and he's made it very clear that he feels it. We're not talking about anything formal that's going to reach out and impose more pain on the president than he's already imposed on himself.
White House counsel Charles Ruff and the president's personal lawyer David Kendall answering questions from reporters this afternoon at the White House. We are reading the Star report today and tonight because the House of Representatives voted this morning to release it to the public. There was vigorous debate on the fairness of that move, and two of the people on opposite sides of that question join us. Now, more to the point, they are two of the people who'll end up deciding what to do with Kenneth Starr's report, because they are both members of the House Judiciary Committee. Zoe Lofgren is a Democratic member of the committee, and she's one of 63 Democrats in the House who voted against releasing the report. She's on the phone with us from Washington. Welcome to the program, Representative Lofgren. And Charles Kennedy also serves on Judiciary. The Florida Republican voted in favor of the release, and he's at home in Virginia. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
I'd like to ask Charles Kennedy, Representative Kennedy, you first. The president's lawyers say that the report that was released today describes sex, an improper relationship, and efforts to cover it up, what it describes doesn't rise to the level of impeachable offense. Do you agree?
Well, I'm still in the process of reviewing the report, and I'm not going to reach any final judgment until I have looked at all the relevant facts. But the picture that is painted here is very disturbing, and specifically, the matters related to perjury and obstruction of justice, I think have to be the focus of our attention. And I believe that if the president did lie under oath, and if the president did obstruct justice, he is guilty of an impeachable offense. The president takes an oath of office to faithfully execute the office of president. He has a duty under our Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. If he commits perjury or obstructs justice, he has violated his oath of office. He has breached his duty under the Constitution, and those are very serious matters.
Representative Lofgren, do you agree that if you came to the conclusion that the president's statements, either in the Paula Jones deposition or before the grand jury, amounted to perjury, that would dictate a vote for impeachment for you?
I think it's important not to render judgments on the ultimate case in the media before we've gone into an appropriate process. But I will say this. The level of severity that constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor is not really in doubt. Many people were reading the Starr report that was issued today. I was also rereading the House Judiciary Report from 1974 that does really a thorough and excellent job outlining the history and the law of impeachment. It's entitled Constitutional Grounds for Presidential Impeachment. I've got it posted on my website for anyone who wants to read it. But here is something that both Republicans and Democrats agreed to and is the standard. It's a constitutional remedy addressed to serious offenses against the system of government. And as they point out in the concluding paragraph of the report back then during the Nixon proceedings, not all presidential misconduct is sufficient to constitute grounds for impeachment.
But
there
if there
is a further requirement of substantiality.
But if there were an act of misconduct by the president that amounted to, if you or I committed it, a felony, should he then be indicted and put on trial in federal court, or does he get a pass on any crime that doesn't rise to the level of a high crime misdemeanor?
The only remedy for removing a president who is sitting is impeachment, and the only cause is subverting the system of government, because this is to protect, not to punish the incumbent, but to protect the Constitution and the system of government. However, as the Founding Fathers pointed out and the Constitution makes clear, after a president serves his term, he's going to be subject to what, the criminal law like any other American, and should be.
Representative Kennedy, the independent counsel said he had to be lurid in order to rebut the president's denials. Does that mean that your committee actually has to be equally lurid, and that as you have hearings, we're going to be hearing about oral sex, unreciprocated, or things that I don't even want to talk about in a radio program?
Well, I don't think any of us want to talk about some of these issues, but the problem is that these issues have been made relevant by the bizarre defense that's being advanced by the president's lawyers. They're taking the position that the president, the position that Ms. Lewinsky had sex with the president, but that the president did not have sex with her. This is bizarre.
Well, I believe they're taking.
I don't know quite what to make of that. I think we've got to end up looking at all of this in context. But I think it's that kind of argument that has made these details about the relationship relevant to the issue of whether perjury, in fact, was committed.
I'd like to hear from both of you your assessment of how soon this matter will be dealt with, and when we can stop hearing about it on the news every night.
Well, you know, one thing I think we ought to consider, in the law, there is a motion called a demur, and my civil procedure professor, Mark Poche, described it as sort of a legal so what. And basically, in the civil law, it says, let's assume, just for argument's sake, that everything you say is accurate. Does it amount to, you know, anything under the law. I think that if we were to apply that kind of demur to this report, we might do a tremendous service for the nation.
And you think very soon we might do that?
Well, I think if that would help to solve this, I think it would be a service, frankly, to the nation.
And Representative Kennedy, how much of a chance would you give for a motion to demur at this point on this report?
Well, I think that would not be availing. For those who believe that perjury by a sitting president is an impeachable offense, that strategy would not produce the result that I think Ms. Lofgren is seeking. The idea that the President of the United States is the chief law enforcement officer in the country and who has the preeminent duty of seeing that the law is executed can commit perjury, obstruct justice, and engage in a pattern of activity over a period of 7 months, all designed to thwart the due administration of justice. If that's what happened, if that is what happened, as is outlined in this report, that is inconsistent with the oath of the president and his duty under the Constitution. And if impeachment is in place for anything, it is in place to help vindicate the rule of law.
And Representative Lofgren, one last word from you.
Actually, if I can quote the 74 bipartisan report, the impeachment of a president is to be predicated only upon conduct seriously incompatible with the constitutional form of government. Mm-hmm. And I think if we do our legal research and our historical research, which we're bound for, we're not allowed to just make this up as we go along, that would be a fruitful thing to do. It's what they did in 1974. We can use the work they already produced.
Well, Representative Lofgren and also Representative Kennedy, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Zoe Lofgren represents the 16th Congressional District of California, and she's a Democrat, and Charles Kennedy is the Republican representative from Florida's 12th District. President Clinton's day began with the annual White House prayer breakfast. Hundreds of religious leaders and ministers attended. So did Mrs. Clinton. And the president began by acknowledging his remorse.
As you might imagine, I have been on quite a journey these last few weeks to get to the end of this, to the rock-bottom truth of where I am and where we all are. I agree with those who have said that in my first statement after I testified, I was not contrite enough. I don't think there is a fancy way to say that I have sinned. It is important to me that everybody who has been hurt know that the sorrow I feel is genuine. First and most important, my family, also my friends, my staff, my cabinet, Monica Lewinsky and her family, and the American people. I have asked all for their forgiveness. But I believe that to be forgiven, more than sorrow is required. At least two more things. First, genuine repentance, a determination to change and to repair breaches of my own making. I have repented. Second, what my Bible calls a broken spirit, an understanding that I must have God's help to be the person that I want to be, a willingness to give the very forgiveness I seek, a renunciation of the pride and the anger which cloud judgment, lead people to excuse and compare, and to blame and complain. Now, what does all this mean for me and for us? First, I will instruct my lawyers to mount a vigorous defense using all available appropriate arguments. But legal language must not obscure the fact that I have done wrong. Second, I will continue on the path of repentance, seeking pastoral support and theirs of other and that of other caring people, so that they can hold me accountable for my own commitment. Third, I will intensify my efforts to lead our country and the world toward peace and freedom, prosperity and harmony, in the hope that with a broken spirit and a still strong heart, I can be used for greater good. For we have many blessings and many challenges and so much work to do.
President Clinton at this morning's prayer breakfast at the White House. Coming up in the next half hour, the question of what impact today's report could have on the Clinton presidency, and we'll hear a reaction from a neighborhood group in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. To recap, today the House of Representatives released a 445-page report, the so-called referral from Kenneth Starr. In it, the independent counsel makes allegations of perjury, obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and witness tampering on the part of the president, which in the words of the report may be grounds for impeachment. The president has admitted that his behavior was wrong, but his lawyers say it was personal, not impeachable. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You're listening to a special report from National Public Radio on 89.9 KCRW, continuing until 8. At 8 o'clock, it's Metropolis. It's 7:30.
The Starr Report, in all its lurid detail, is out for anyone with a computer modem anywhere in the world to see. How will Congress take to the independent prosecutor's detailed referral? Monday on Which Way LA, will Democrats join Republicans in response to allegations of high crimes and misdemeanors by the president? Warren Olney returns to host Which Way LA's White House Watch, Monday at 1, repeated at 7 on 89.9 KCRW.
From NPR News in Washington, The Starr Report. I'm Robert Siegel. Today, the House of Representatives made the independent counsel's report on the Monica Lewinsky affair public. By CD-ROM and Internet, the document went out to news organizations and the public, the counsel's version of the relationship between the president and the intern, and his argument that they constitute 11 grounds for impeachment. In this half hour, what California's top Democrat and what some experienced Washington political writers make of it all. First, though, this has been an extraordinary day here in Washington. The president held to his schedule that tried to maintain the illusion of business as usual, while nearly everyone else in official Washington reacted to previews of the news, interpretations of the news, and finally in mid-afternoon to the release of the independent counsel's report. NPR's Neil Conan charts for us the course of the day.
Washington awoke to headlines that seemed both inevitable and shocking. Clinton lied, obstructed justice, impeachment report contends, was the header in the Washington Post. The Washington Times was more concise. Impeachable offenses spelled out. Then, before most people had settled in at their desks, the president was making a new act of contrition on television at the prayer breakfast at the White House. That bit of scheduling was pure coincidence and provided him an opportunity to reiterate some apologies and add a new one.
First and most important, my family. Also, my friends, my staff, my cabinet, Monica Lewinsky and her family, and the American people.
As the House of Representatives gathered in mid-morning to vote on the release of the Starr Report, motorcades from the White House, the Pentagon, and the State Department converged on the National Cathedral, where a memorial service was scheduled for those killed in the embassy bombings in East Africa last month. Outside, the cathedral grounds sparkled in the sunshine of a spectacular late summer day. A dozen 3- and 4-year-olds walking by to the St. Albans Daycare Center knew their routine had been disrupted by something unusual. Where, one kid asked, Where is the president? While the memorial continued in the cathedral overlooking the city, across town, on Capitol Hill, the House cast its historic vote to disseminate the Star Report immediately on the World Wide Web.
All time having expired, the yeas are 363, the nays are 63. The resolution is adopted. Motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Immediate electronic publication turned out to take a few hours, but more and more parts of the report began to spill out. The lunchtime crowd in the bar at the Monocle restaurant on Capitol Hill interrupted the conversations that justified their expense account chits to drink in the latest details from CNN.
The president committed perjury. One thing the president's lawyers point out in their briefing, they say laws governing perjury require intent, and the president had no information.
The House press gallery, overwhelmed by the size of the report and the demands of the news media, turned over production of hard copies of the 445-page report to, where else, Kinko's. As several thick sheaves were assembled to make a complete copy, it was hefted into a cardboard box and issued in the order in which the reporters had forked over their $35 plus tax.
John McKinney? Are you here?
No, that's number two right there.
How about Jennifer?
A few blocks away, the staff of Representative Heather Wilson downloaded a couple of copies of the report from the Internet. Wilson is a Republican from New Mexico who was elected to an open seat in Congress just 2.5 months ago. Late this afternoon, before she'd had a chance to read it, she met with her staff in her office on the fourth floor of the Rayburn Building across the street from the Capitol and warned them not to get caught up in the frenzy.
We have to take it very seriously. I don't want anybody to be partisan or flippant about any of this, and that includes all you guys.
We receive calls. What should we tell people?
If the evidence justifies going forward with a full impeachment investigation, then I'll support it. If the evidence doesn't justify it, then I won't, and I take this as a serious, solemn constitutional responsibility.
At the White House tonight, the bagpipes welcomed several hundred Irish Americans to a South Lawn celebration of the peace agreement in Northern Ireland.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and Mrs. Clinton, the Vice President of the United States.
This was an invited crowd, there to hail a diplomatic triumph, but still, it was the first group that Bill Clinton faced in public since details of his affair with Monica Lewinsky had been published. The ovation for the president and Mrs. Clinton appeared to catch them by surprise. Twice Mr. Clinton sat down, twice the cheers brought him out of his seat. On perhaps the most critical and certainly the most embarrassing day of his presidency, this had to be a gratifying reception, a rare moment when no apologies were needed or asked for. Neil Conan, NPR News, Washington.
The reception for Mr. Clinton among some Democrats may not be so enthusiastic. For a look at how the president's troubles could affect the Democratic Party's prospects in the November midterm elections, we're joined now by Art Torres, the party chairman in California. He's speaking to us from Los Angeles. Welcome, Mr. Torres.
Thank you.
This can't help today, what's happened, can it?
Quite frankly, it is helping. The calls that we've been getting in our offices in San Francisco and Sacramento and Los Angeles has emboldened the Democratic activists who are just angry. And I'm still surprised by the number of calls that we've received. There's even an effort now that started without our support and without our knowledge that was faxed to us of people trying to congregate in front of the Comedy Store to impeach Kenneth Starr tomorrow evening in Hollywood. California is looking at this very seriously in terms of degrading what really we should be talking about.
I mean, do you really think it's going to be an assist, say, to Senator Boxer and to other Democratic candidates when President Clinton goes out there toward the end of the month?
I think what has happened here is that people are looking at this as a voyeuristic romance novel by Ken Starr and his cronies that all it lacks is a cover that we've seen in other romance novels. I think people really don't see what $40 million has bought them. And the nature of how this report was written was not written in legalistic terms. It was written in erotic terms that it surprises many of us.
But even if Democratic activists...
The issues here are for the House of Representatives to determine under the Constitution, not an independent prosecutor who obviously has an obsession with sex.
But even if Democratic activists are mobilized by this, as you say, you can't win an election with Democratic activists.
We're not winning an election based upon President Clinton's behavior, which was reprehensible. We're not talking about that. We're talking about voters that are much smarter than we give them credit for, who are concerned about education, the environment, jobs. People who talk about, that I talk to in the Central Valley and other parts of the state as I've been traveling the last month, are concerned about the public morality issues that Barbara Boxer talked about on the floor of the Senate, that Gray Davis, our gubernatorial candidate, talks about in cities like Fresno and Modesto and Stockton.
But we've been hearing from pollsters and political watchers all around the country that these events really could dissuade a lot of otherwise likely Democratic voters to even turn up, because it's just too disgusting.
Party members are disgusted with how the Republicans have characterized this whole episode and have continued to harp on it, and now, after they've seen the report in great anticipation, are wondering, where did $40 million go? People are incensed, the calls that are coming into our offices, and quite frankly, I'm surprised at the number of calls that have come in today. Clearly, we're not condoning the president's behavior, don't get me wrong. We're concerned, however, about more important issues that affect us here in California on a day-to-day basis, and those are the issues that Barbara Boxer's been talking about, those are the issues that Gray Davis has been talking about, issues that we care about here in California, and that's in addition to the issues that we've raised, the reaction and the anger at how this process has taken place.
Well, Mr. Torres
got an opportunity to respond to the charges against him before his report about lying to the Congress was published.
Well, Mr. Torres, thank you very much for talking with us and describing the silver lining that you found in the cloud today out there in California. Art Torres is chairman of the Democratic Party in California and spoke to us from Los Angeles. Joining us now to discuss the Star Report and its likely consequences for the Clinton presidency are three of our colleagues from the Washington Press Corps. First, Washington journalist Elizabeth Drew, David Brooks of the Weekly Standard, Ron Elving, political editor of USA Today. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be here.
And I'd just like to go around first and hear from each of you, generally and briefly, what your reactions to this report are. Elizabeth Drew, what do you make of it?
Well, I'm going to shock you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not as all that lurid and terrible as it's being portrayed. And I think it's worth summoning up the dogs that didn't bark. Mr. Starr was looking for a pattern of obstruction on a number of subjects. He didn't find them on anything else, and so he's raised it on this one, which, as Nina was saying earlier, is quite questionable. There were rumors, and they even made it into print, that there was another intern. Now, I think that would have blown the president out of the White House probably by Tuesday. Mr. Starr felt obliged to show that the president probably lied in the Paula Jones deposition and then when he appeared before the grand jury. But what we have here is almost sad. It's what we used to call, when I was single, heavy petting and oral sex by people who didn't want to, what we used to say, go all the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they did it 12 times or whatever. And Mr. Starr has to tell you about all 12 times. Is his behavior condonable? Absolutely not. Was it stupid? Yes. Was it reckless? Yet. But what is the proportionate punishment for this? That's really the question.
Okay. David Brooks of the Weekly Standard.
Yeah, I think there's a consensus building around town that the perjury stuff is rock solid. That is the heart of the matter. The obstruction is pretty serious. Tampering of Betty Curry's testimony, suggesting that Monica Lewinsky filed a false affidavit.
Betty Curry, we should remind her, was the president's secretary.
Right. But I think it's a mistake to focus too much on the legalistic aspects, because the impeachment hearings and the process in Congress from now on out is a political process. And surely the most surprising, gripping, moving positively and negatively aspect of the report is the narrative of the relationship between these two, and not just the sexual matters, but also the emotional relationship, because there's this odd back and forth between emotional intimacy and sort of just crude physicality. And that's what I think is going to affect people the most. And it's the approval ratings that really will be the driving engine on how Congress takes this up.
And you would expect there to be a big difference between what people have said knowing that there was some kind of sex, oral sex, in the Oval Office, and now seeing the details of it in narrative?
Not a big difference. I think at the moment, people will continue the same reaction, which is, we find his behavior reprehensible. We want him to stay as president. Now, the big question over the next month, is this a tenable position? Can you believe, over a period of months, that your president is reprehensible? Does one of those two views fade away? And frankly, I would say, simply by the force of inertia, it would be the moral outrage that would fade away.
Ron Elving of USA Today, what do you think about it?
Well, as a portrait of our president, the leader of our nation, who comes across as a somewhat adolescent sexual actor, it's rather pathetic, I thought, and it's depressing to contemplate. On the other hand, I think a lot of this has already been public knowledge and certainly has been within the Beltway, which is one of the reasons why the Beltway has been so much more critical of the president than the rest of the country. As a bodice ripper, which it in some senses seems to aspire to being, it's rather a bit dull and not terribly successful in that genre. But as an impeachment document, which is ultimately what it's supposed to be, it seems a bit light. It seems a bit thin. And I think that even some of the people who are pushing hard for either impeachment or resignation were just a tad disappointed with it today and even could be sensed to be perceptibly pulling back a little bit from their pronouncements or their time frames because there wasn't anything really in it except Monica and the cover-up and the lying about Monica. Now, there are 11 counts that the independent counsel says are impeachable offenses. In the 11, in the language of the 11, Monica Lewinsky's name appears in 9 and might as well have appeared in the other 2. This is a case, as it comes down to, ultimately about this relationship between these two people.
And there is one mention at the beginning of this referral that work is nearing completion on all the other areas of the independent counsel's investigation, that is the real estate deal, the Filegate, the travel office. But the implication there would be that there wasn't enough to warrant rushing information from those investigations over to the Congress, so seems unlikely we're going to hear about anything impeachable from those investigations.
Well, I think that's exactly right, that he defined them out of the impeachment report. But, you know, Robert, there's an awful lot of talk that there's only one thing to do about the president, or maybe two. One is he has to leave, impeach him, he has to leave office, or you leave him there, and it's as if you leave him there, and he is not punished at all. He is being punished plenty right now. His presidency has been disgraced and damaged. It's not like you have to have capital punishment for each offense. And I think that's what the debate ought to be. I'm frankly a little disheartened. As you know, I wrote about the Nixon impeachment. I'm a little disheartened at the number of people in the Congress, on the Judiciary Committee, who are already pronouncing if it's this, then that's an impeachable offense. That's a very, it's a huge question. It's a country-wrenching question. It should be and always has been something people take months to study and figure out. But and there is a rush here.
But Elizabeth, isn't there, and all of you, isn't there something unsatisfying or unsatisfactory about saying that if somebody, in fact, committed perjury, that to suffer the loss of support in the Congress and loss of esteem in the polls as president, that's ample punishment. That's not our punishment if we commit perjury.
Well, but does it mean that he should be hanged or beheaded? I mean, we have to have some grade. You know, in colonial times, when you wanted to punish someone, the worst punishment was to shame him. Put him in the public square and shame him. And that is what is going on. I think there could be a resolution of censure or something even worse. I'm not saying what it should be. I'm just struck by people think there's only one thing to do or not do.
Yeah. David Brooks?
Well, there's been an interesting evolution on Capitol Hill among the House Republicans on how to deal with this. Far from wanting to get Clinton immediately and be filled with rage about him, the House Republicans held a meeting yesterday morning before this was made public, at which Newt Gingrich and the vast majority of the members wanted to push it back till next year, wanted to be statesmanlike, wanted to drag it out over a long period to show that they were sort of could live up to the occasion. A very small minority, people like Linda Smith of Washington and Tom DeLay, wanted to get to move on it quickly. And I think the important lesson to be learned from that is that the Republicans are less interested in getting Bill Clinton than they are in showing that they themselves and their institution can do a good job.
Well, there's one other consideration.
Yes, Ron Elving.
In the minds of these Republicans and Democrats alike, and that's November 3rd. All of the members of the House have to run for re-election that November 3rd, all the ones who are not retiring, and they're, of course, tight races for the seats that are vacant, and one-third of the Senate. And the calculation that they're trying to make at this point is, will this help me or hurt me if we rush ahead with this or if we put it off until after the election? And I think earlier in the year, there was a clear consensus that everyone would be better off if the thing could be delayed. But that, of course, didn't include Ken Starr. Ken Starr said, I have no reason to delay. And he rushed this thing up there the other day before anybody really even was expecting it. And neither the House nor the Senate really knows what to do.
Elizabeth Drew, as you said, you wrote about the Nixon, about Watergate and the House impeachment, House Judiciary Committee proceedings on impeachment in that case. Do you, in looking at the charges, say, of perjury, and there's some attempt to construe a case here of abusive power, does it seem at all akin to what was impeachable in those days, or is this history repeating itself as bedroom farce 25 years later?
Well, I think that they're on different planets in different universes, and the only thing that might affect that is I think our politics have changed, and even with the early reactions, you can see that it is more partisan. Our politics are meaner. There was not the same kind of rush to judgment then. People were very, very much more careful. But there were three articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. The first one was obstruction of justice. Now, this wasn't just suggesting, you know, leading a witness.
So this telling was, John Dean, you can say you can't
no,
recall.
No, this was using the FBI and the CIA to cover up a crime, a series of crimes. There was a goon squad run out of the White House, paid by campaign money, to break into the Democratic headquarters. And to me, the most frightening thing, and this was the second article of impeachment against Richard Nixon, they raided the offices of the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg, who had released the Pentagon Papers. And as Sam Ervin said in his wonderful, simple way of getting to the point,
he was the chairman of the Senate
chairman
committee
of the
that
Senate
investigated
hearings. That. Every man's home is his castle. This is the Fourth Amendment, the right of privacy and from search and seizure. It was very frightening. And so this was abuse of the constitutional protections of the people. And the third was a whole series of defying the committee and not cooperating with it, which was much less important and majestic than the first two. What we're talking about here isn't anywhere close to that. It is serious. It is terrible behavior on the part of a president, but it's a whole nother world.
Well, what do you think about that, David Brooks, that these are perhaps they reach the standard of impeachable offenses, but they don't seem as menacing to our system of government or to the public as the Nixon's offenses were? We would be then cheapening the whole process of impeachment.
Yeah, well, I think that's certainly right. Nixon's people weren't only guilty, they were really, really guilty. But I think one difference, and this is not a total difference, one difference, Elizabeth can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think by the time the Rodino House Judiciary Committee hearings took place, trials were already ongoing, there were already indictments, and the information was flowing out of those trials. In this case, the indictments, if there are any, have yet to come. So maybe more information on Whitewater and some of those other matters will come forth. But I think it's no doubt true that Watergate was a more serious effect of event. But you still have the essential problem, how do you tell people to tell the truth if the president lies? You know, we have had impeachments before that were based simply on lying to grand juries. So, you know, how do you bend
judicial
that
judicial impeachments?
That's correct.
But those reversed presidential nomination and the approval by the Senate, not a national election. Yeah. But you would agree it's a different standard.
No, I agree. I agree completely. You're sitting on the House Judiciary Committee. You believe the man perjured himself. You have firm evidence. You believe he obstructed justice. It's hard to not vote yes for impeachment. On the other hand, a lot of those people are going to want to vote against impeachment because they think it'll hurt them politically because of the approval ratings.
Well, I'm going to irresponsibly ask each of you to speculate about the future right now as we wrap up. Do you think a year from now, Bill Clinton will still be president of the United States? Elizabeth Drew?
You can be irresponsible and I can be unresponsive. I don't know.
I knew that.
There's going to be a dynamic that started today and it's going to go on, and there's no way to know where this is going to come out. But I think one thing is clear. This report is not really as damaging as it was expected to be.
And David Brooks of the Weekly Standard?
Yeah, I'd lose my pundit license if I didn't know the future. I suspect that he will be around for a year. We'll have a long, drawn-out hearings, and it'll just sort of wither.
And Ron Elving of USA Today?
I beg for one conditional. If his polls do not drop precipitously after this report, then yes, I think he will be around a year from now.
And when are you looking, by the way, for that drop? Tomorrow, the day after, or over a week?
Over the next 3 to 5 days.
Okay. Well, Ron Elving, Elizabeth Drew, and David Brooks, thank you all very much for talking with us this evening.
Thank you.
We asked NPR's David Molpes to follow the day's events with some of his neighbors in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. They watched the evening news together, and then they talked about what they'd seen and learned, and he found that all were disappointed by the findings in the Star Report. Some wanted Mr. Clinton to resign. Others wanted him to remain in office.
All four guests looked somewhat grave as they listened to the detailed allegations against the president and were uncomfortable commenting on them. Some had held out hope that the Star Report wouldn't be so damaging, but are now saying, it looks like all this happened. It's very upsetting, said one. It's stuff I don't want to know, said another.
The only thing in which I'm interested in is if perjury was committed. All the sexual embellishments and things, I have absolutely no interest.
That's Douglas Zinn, who is not quite ready to conclude that the president perjured himself, but is coming close to that. Zinn, a charitable foundation administrator, is among those with a lot of mixed feelings. Disappointment with the president, whom he has supported in the past, and anger at the political and legal process that got us to this point.
It would be so much easier, I think, for the American public if Bill Clinton were a bad president and unliked. Then I think we would be non-forgiving or less forgiving. But because his presidency has so many pluses in terms of policies and things, it makes it difficult, and we want to rationalize or try to sympathize or any way we can for him. But now that these facts or supposed reputed facts have come out, I'm thinking more along the lines of resignation, lying to me, to close friends, family, and the American public. There's no other solution, unfortunately.
What bothers you most about what we're hearing in this report?
What we've just been talking about in terms of when can you believe Bill Clinton?
Jim Abrahamson is a Christian minister in Chapel Hill.
Once a person lies in a position of authority, then, especially if they lie convincingly, as he has, then when he wants to be believed, people are going to doubt him. And now I think part of his credibility problem comes from the fact that we don't know when to believe him, because he was so convincing before. And I think that the other factor, too, is the fact that his comments seem to be only coming forward when they are pressed by political expediency. He isn't volunteering information that he doesn't have to until the political cards are necessary to be played.
The president's talk of personal sin at today's Washington prayer breakfast did not seem to carry a lot of weight with most in this group, especially in the context of Mr. Clinton still claiming through his lawyers that he did not have sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky. Psychologist Stephen Mullinex.
I don't think he's telling the truth now. I think there's two different things. He's telling the truth to the ministers he spoke to today, but legally he's trying to walk a very fine line. And as was stated in the news tonight, that he may ask for forgiveness and admit what's going on, but he's reluctant to take any realistic consequences about what's there.
However, Mullinex's wife, Connie, a healthcare consultant, says Mr. Clinton merely did what most people would do when caught in an embarrassing situation. They cover it up, at least partially, especially if the truth would harm the family.
I'm still loyal to the president, and I'm sitting here with three men, and I'm probably the only one that's saying I'm still loyal to the president. I believe that our technology for finding out what a president is doing may have gone beyond our ethics, and I feel like we know more about this president than any of our others, and we're holding him to a different standard.
One resident here, listening to these different opinions, said there's a part of him that agrees with all that was said. It's a very conflicting thing. David Malpas, NPR News, Chapel Hill.
To wrap up our special broadcast on the Star Report, we can conclude only this. Kenneth Starr, after investigating President Clinton, starting with the matters of the Whitewater real estate deal in Arkansas and the attempt to fire the White House travel office staff, claims that members of the White House staff improperly dealt with FBI files, began at the end of last year to look into allegations that Mr. Clinton had had, and then later had lied about, an affair with Monica Lewinsky. Today, his report includes a narrative that describes, mostly her, but in many cases corroborated by other details, an account of the relationship between her and the president. And on the basis of that narrative, Mr. Starr concludes that there is substantial and credible information supporting 11 possible grounds for impeachment. That the president lied under oath in the civil case brought by Paula Jones, that he lied under oath to the grand jury, that in his civil deposition to support a false statement about the relationship, the president lied about the gifts that were exchanged by him and Ms. Lewinsky, that he lied under oath about his discussions with Ms. Lewinsky concerning her involvement in the Jones case. The special prosecutor, or independent counsel, as he's formally called, suggests there might be grounds also for impeachment for obstruction of justice and abusive power, he claims, and all of the claims of privilege that the president's lawyers made. This report is now in the hands of the House, and it'll be taken up by the Committee on the Judiciary. But the president's lawyers have also released their view of what it all amounts to, and they say that this is a flimsy and unsubstantiated case for impeachment, and that all that it is an attempt to embarrass the president. This is NPR, National Public Radio.